The Committee on Education and General Government to order. Happy New Year to everyone. Today we're going through information reports and updates on online education, school facilities, pest management, and we have a couple of action items to formally introduce legislation that we'll hear in February. During the session last year, we passed Senate Bill 767, which, among other things, created an online task force to prepare legislation and a report back to the legislature. That report is back due today and is front of us here and now. And I'd like to call the co-chairs of the task force, Senator Devlin and Representative Gelser, up here. And I would note that our own Senators Morris and Bonamici were on that task force. So, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I have here an 8-page document of my testimony that I could read to you line by line, but I've been requested by the chair to be much more succinct than that. So I'm going to basically read to you from the first two-thirds of the first page and then just make a couple of brief comments. The Online Learning Task Force was established with Senate Bill 767. The 17 committee members on the task force represented a vast variety of parties involved in online learning. The task force held 5 public meetings and took testimony from 2 national experts, a representative of the State Board of Education, a coalition of school superintendents, members of the statewide education community, and parents and students currently enrolled in virtual schools. Task force members received numerous research papers, curriculum descriptions, a demonstration of online programs and technology, and a large volume of public comment provided in writing. LC 15, which is what's being submitted on the House side for our February session, is designed to address the issues that the task force identified as the highest priorities that are practical to address in the short February session. These issues are issues surrounding governance, accountability, quality, funding, and equitable access to online education in Oregon. Rather than go through each one of the sections, what I'd like to do is highlight what I think are 4 or 5 of the most important sections in the bill. The first one would be in Section 1, the requirements of notice to each student's residence and sponsoring district when they enroll in or withdraw from virtual schools. The issue here primarily is that we've been identified in our research that the virtual schools that exist practically anywhere have a high degree of turnover. For example, I believe in the last full years for ORCA, about 2,000 students left the school in 1 year with an enrollment of about 2,500. There is no proper way to actually probably pre-screen those students to see if they would flourish in a fully online environment. All that this requirement does, and it's pretty much accepted by all the parties that were in this discussion, including the online providers, and Mr. Temple, the superintendent of the SIO school district, has been trying to do this as dutifully as he can, is keeps the communication on between the sponsoring school district and the resident school district for the students, so if they don't succeed at the virtual school, the school district where they are actually a resident of knows that they are no longer enrolled, and the student can either return to public school, return to a public charter school, or return to home school. We do believe that that's one of the more important provisions in the bill. Also, when 767 passed, both co-chairs made promises on the floor that we would deal with an error we believe was made in the bill. That's in the situation of ORVA. Basically, what we had put in place was that schools were limited to their enrollment effective, I believe, May 1st, 2009. However, current waivers were honored that were in place at that time. ORVA had another year on its waiver and had already admitted students for the forthcoming year. What this actually allows ORVA to do is to keep those numbers of students that they've admitted in that forthcoming year, so that they don't have to now disenroll students that they already have. The next provision is Section 5, which actually came from the two co-chairs. About a couple weeks before the task force had completed its work, we were sitting going over all the testimony we had received, and we discovered what we believe is a flaw that should have been addressed. And one of them is that for the existing virtual school programs, the larger programs, ORCA and ORVA, to believe somehow that they could wait until July 1st, 2011 to get a new waiver would be very impractical in terms of being able to have a 2011 school year. So there's provisions in 5 allows the State Board of Education to basically act upon those waivers earlier than that, so they have plenty of notice for the forthcoming school year. One of the things that we did, we were given quite a number of charges from the legislature in 767. And we basically took some of those charges, decided that they were not as well-founded as we thought they were. There was not adequate information to act upon them. And some of the charges we kept for the task force, and some we sent back to the State Board of Education. Probably the principal one that we sent back to the State Board of Education with their sincere interest in looking at this issue was the issue of governance and what should be the structure for virtual schools. Should it be under the charter school law? Should it be under another law? Not saying that it shouldn't still be under the charter school law, but they wanted an interest in addressing that. The final provision actually affects this committee and the House committee directly. That is the provision that I think everybody on the task force agreed. The provisions that we have around virtual schools and the provisions that we have around charter schools, when you put them in the same section of the statute, are extremely confusing. And trying to actually do legislation that affects either charter schools directly or virtual charter schools directly is very difficult without implying something for the other. If you do virtual schools, you're going to affect charter schools. If you do charter schools, and we're recommending very strongly that both education committees look at splitting that statute so that there's the charter school statute that you have, and there's also another statute on virtual charter schools or virtual schools, including virtual charter schools, because it's very confusing within that statute. It was extremely confusing for the committee, was extremely confusing for people appearing before the committee to try to keep that straight, and probably very, very confusing to the public.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Sarah Gelser, state representative from Corvallis and Philomath, and had the opportunity to co-chair this task force with Senator Devlin and to serve with Senator Bonamici and Senator Morse. I think that Senator Devlin has done a good job outlining the recommendations that are coming forward in LC 15. That will be a committee bill in the House Education Committee. I was surprised as we moved into this task force how collaborative the conversation became as we moved forward. Some of you may remember that this issue took on, I don't know if the word divisive would be a stretch,
might be an understatement.
during the session. But what we found was that there really was a lot of common ground among those who have concerns about virtual schools and those who are involved with virtual schools about providing quality public education to students, making sure that there is adequate funding for education for students. And along that common ground is where some of these proposals came forward. It's simply, I think there was also some common ground from advocates on both sides of the issue that they wish that we could have gone further in this legislation. The challenge is that they would have been about equally split in what that definition of further would have been. It would have taken them further away from one another and from consensus. And with the limited number of meetings that we had, it made more sense to send this back to the State Board with their blessing. We do have a timeline for them to bring those recommendations back, which are September 1st, which means it will be a very transparent process, and we will get to continue to work in collaboration with a very open give and take with the State Board of Education moving forward. I think the other thing that I always want to take the opportunity to say on the record, because I know there are families out there that are listening and paying attention, and sometimes all of the work that we do here can be mystifying to people that don't live in this building every day, but there is nothing in LC 15 that closes a virtual online school. There is nothing in LC 15 that threatens the enrollment of any student that is currently receiving virtual online school services. So this is, I think, an important bill to move us forward and continue having a constructive conversation about how to best use new technology to meet the needs of students in the 21st century.
Thank you. Comments from Senator Bonamici or Senator Morse, also on the task force. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for your diligent hard work on this issue. One maybe very, very small in terms of a policy issue, but very large in terms of the interests of a very small group of students, that because of the caps and ORVA being grade 8, that are left in limbo if they want to pursue continue online. Is that with respect to the statement that you made, Representative, about we're not going to deny those that are in the system? What about that group that is kind of left in a suspense?
Thank you for that question, Chair Haas, Senator Morris. I think what's important to remember is there's nothing in this bill that changes that circumstance. For years, ORVA has been a K-8 school, and to come in and talk about an expansion during a time when we're having a pause, I think is a different question than preserving the status quo of what we have right now. ORVA, if they chose to comply with the 50% rule, could certainly go and expand to grades 9 through 12, but that was a decision that was made at the point of obtaining the current waiver that they have from the state board to be a K-8 school. There is the opportunity in this legislation to consider a waiver that would go into effect July 1st of 2011, and certainly as part of that waiver, ORVA could seek to expand to 9 through 12. But again, 9 through 12 has never been offered through ORVA. There's nothing in this bill that changes that or rolls that back. This year's 8th graders are in the same position that last year's 8th graders were and the 8th graders the school year before that. And they could enroll in ORCA.
In essence, they would have one additional year in which before they could apply for a new waiver. So next school year, they would still be under the next circumstances. But the children in the next school year actually could potentially, if they were granted a waiver by the Board of Education, could enroll the following year in the ninth grade at ORVA if the waiver was granted. The 2010, next year will be the 2010-2011 year. And the year after that, they could be granted a waiver effective July 1st, 2011, which would be the following school year. So the kids that are currently in would still have the same problem as the kids that were in last year.
Exactly. I think the other thing that's important to point out in terms of ORVA, I think LC15 is particularly important, I would argue, to the families and students at ORVA, because under the terms of the existing waiver, they continued to grow their enrollment this year, and I believe it was a couple hundred kids. There is a fix in this legislation that ensures those couple hundred kids that enrolled this year can continue attending next year, even though that waiver expires.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Devlin and Representative Gelser, for all your work on this. I just wanted to make a comment. When we were in the task force, we had a lot of discussions about different models of online learning, and the LC draft and the report tend to deal with the full-time online learning, and I wanted to make it clear to people who are here and listening that I know for myself and most of the task force and probably everybody, that we aren't intending to limit online opportunities to students in existing brick-and-mortar schools. We didn't really tackle that issue. There's a lot of potential out there for additional online learning opportunities within existing schools, and we didn't address that. We talked about it, but we didn't address it in this LC draft, and I think we probably the whole task force would agree that that's something that we need to continue to have conversations about, to make sure that students in existing schools, particularly rural schools where they might not have the opportunity to take, for example, an AP class or an IB class or a class that's not offered, we need to continue to have those conversations. And I don't think that the work of this task force is any way intended to deter or inhibit those opportunities for students in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First a comment, then a question. Actually, I see three issues. It's the virtual charter and how that interplays with brick-and-mortar charter. There does need to be some definition there. I would agree with that. It is somewhat confusing. So how we differentiate those two, I think, is significant. But during the last session, Representative Roblin and I had work groups, and we also separated out that the virtual offerings in traditional brick-and-mortar school was also a huge issue that we really haven't done a good job on. The Department of Ed has their little thing that's somewhat vapid at this point in time, and but that's an issue I think we need to move forward with significantly, and I'm hoping those are the sorts of things that you are charging these committees to deal with heading towards 2011. Is that fairly accurate? Or
I think some of that, there is a charge, obviously, to the Education Committee on looking at the split of the statute. But I think some of the issues surrounding the issues that have been referred back to the Board of Education, the governance issue, are much broader than just virtual charter schools. They're affecting, and that's our impression from talking to the board or members of the board, is that their interest is much broader than just the virtual charter school portion of it in terms of governance.
Okay. Ms. Chair, if I could, rumors fly in this building, and I heard a rumor that this bill, which is going to be introduced, I believe, Representative Gelser, in your committee, will not come to this side of the building and will go directly to Ways and Means. Is that true?
There is a fiscal on this bill because of the work that we're tasking with the State Board of doing, and on the rapid timeline, because of the interplay of the, because they have to come back by September 1st. Because there is a legitimate fiscal, and because of the timeline in the building, it does have to go to Ways and Means. Certainly will be up to how it gets referred.
Right.
Over
it will be up to both presiding officers in each chamber, but it would be the normal circumstance that, as you know, a lot of times bills that start in one chamber that have a fiscal go through the policy committee in that chamber, then to Ways and Means, and then to the floor in both chambers. It doesn't have to be the way it happens.
Right.
I guess a lot of it would depend upon timing, and a lot of it would depend upon the interest of parties in the Senate to actually have some additional purview over the bill also. But that would be quite a normal process many times for bills in the legislature, regardless of which chamber they originate out of.
Right, Ms. Chair. It can go one of two ways, and I know we're going to be compressed in February, but I think it would be beneficial. Definitely, it has to go to Ways and Means at some point in time, but it can go through both chambers' policy committees before it gets there potentially, and we kind of have not done as much of that recently as I think would be prudent. So I would suggest that may be a discussion we need to have, is that we be allowed to take a look at it as well before it goes to Ways and Means.
May I, mm-hmm. Mr. Chair? I think that certainly the goal of this has been to have an open process where people are involved and engaged. My one plea would be, there are some important pieces of this bill, particularly the books, the protections for those students that enrolled this year, and that ability to grant a waiver to go into effect on July 1st. So I would just hope, however it happens, that it doesn't go through a path that causes the time to run out on the clock and have a bunch of kids pay the consequences for that.
Mr. Chair, that clearly would not be my intention. My intention would clearly be, this isn't a delay or stall or a death tactic that I'm suggesting. It's just there's some significant policy in here, and I think it would behoove us for both chamber policy committees to opine before the budget issue comes up. So,
Mr. Chairman, if I might speak a little bit out of turn here, in our charges that we are making with their cooperation to the State Board of Education, not speaking for the task force, but speaking for myself, I think the principal charge there is to see if they have a governance model that would be acceptable to the legislature that they would want to propose. We worked with some interests, and they brought us information on funding and the funding levels for charters, virtual charter schools. And actually, at least from the preliminary evidence that we had, we didn't see any real significant issue in terms of whether or not the funding was appropriate. It's a very complex issue, but the reality is that on average, brick-and-mortar school districts receive more funding than actually virtual charter schools. On the other side of that equation, though, is because of the experiences, bricks-and-mortar charter schools end up with far more children on IEPs and with special needs, and that explains part of the funding. When you look at those two in combination, the funding that they actually receive is probably just as inadequate as the funding that the bricks-and-mortar regular public schools receive. But we put that in there because people wanted to continue to study the issue. There is a provision in the bill that was widely accepted by all the interests, and that is that they go to the same chart of accounts, simply so you compare apples to apples, oranges to oranges. The other provision that's put off to the Board of Education is the issue about children with special needs and the equity in terms of in virtual charter schools. That issue, as you all know, having been education committee members for a long time, is a deep... We could have a two-year study with huge resources and not be able to answer all of those questions. So I'm expecting some comment back from the Board of Education, but I do not expect that they are going to come up with something that's going to say this is the direction we should go, because I think there are significant issues both... on the side of the children, there are significant issues on just basically how those services are performed. There are significant issues on whether if the virtual charter schools actually get more of those children, and they are getting more of those children now, of whether or not under our current system they will get adequate resources to deal with those children, even if they do have them enroll. So I think there are a lot of issues there, but I do not have high hopes that the Board of Education is going to resolve that issue within 6 months.
I have some questions on simple rules and boundaries. For example, you did not address, the task force did not address really things like is online education acceptable for first grade or second grade? And I remember during our hearings last year we had conflicting testimony on that point, for example.
Well, one of the things we found, Mr. Chairman, and maybe Representative Gelser should comment on this also, is that trying to find research on online learning, full-time virtual schools, is extremely difficult. And the research I think we did find in that area was somewhat contradictory between various researchers, and we came to the conclusion that the task force would never come to any conclusion on that particular issue, and we actually doubted if in the near future if even the Board of Education would come to any conclusion on that issue. However, even though I think it's a pretty light thing, we actually did take an interest, and I think it's in the staff report, that as people in the state are looking at research issues, particularly in our schools of education, that they start to consider some of these areas for possible areas of research, because we really found in many areas not very much research to be able to rely on, and I think Representative Gelser and certainly the committee administrator, who we have not commented on, who has actually performed unbelievably admirably during this process, accepting vast new responsibilities and short timelines, and so I better get that on the record, actually.
Mr. Chair, we've known for a fair period of time that she's really good. So.
Thank you both for your work and for all of the task force members. We will chew on this in the session to come. And this is one of those education issues that is not going away. It will just keep changing as technology keeps changing. So thank you both.
Thank you.
I'll close the informational session, and I will open up an informational update session on a report from the School Facilities Task Force from House Bill 2013, and have those people come forward. Louis Caraballo and Robin Kirkpatrick. Presentation. You got a slideshow?
No, sir.
Okay. Welcome.
Chairperson Haas, members of the committee, my name is Luis Caraballo. I am the chairperson of the Oregon School Facilities Task Force, and I am the director of facilities and planning for Salem-Keizer Public Schools. At your request, I'm here before you today, along with several members of our task force, to provide you with an update on the status of the work that we've been doing through the task force. As you know, the bill provided for a task force of 15 persons. Appointments to the task force began in October, and we had our first meeting of the task force in mid-November. As of last week, actually, we had a full complement of appointees to the committee. Let me begin my substantive comments, first of all, by stating that the task force, along with many folks across the state, are very pleased with the establishment of the task force, as it really begins to address a number of issues that are of great concern to us as practitioners and to districts, as we have huge policy issues around facilities. Many of these practitioners are well aware of the growing evidence in a correlation between the adequacy of school facilities and student behavior and educational performance. Many facility practitioners as well believe that policymakers should be concerned about the relationship between school facilities and student learning and achievement, not only because of the health, security, and psychological issues, but also because of because of failure to create and maintain optimum learning environments can undermine other efforts to reform education. It's evidence from House Bill 2013 that Oregon policymakers do understand the importance of these issues, and this effort now allows us to begin the dialogue on very important issues versus being at the table having the same discussion as an outcome of litigation as has been the experience in a number of other states. As the task force has met and analyzed the bill, it has become increasingly clear that the scope of work charged in the bill is quite comprehensive. The bill has charged that we analyze everything from the physical plant to the educational standards that drive facility needs to include how these needs are underwritten. We've provided you a little chart that is actually a composition from the bill on the left to talk about a little bit of the scope of work that you have actually asked us to undertake over the next year. Despite the comprehensive delineation of the issues, however, some key issues were not specifically addressed and were left to the task force to determine if and how we would address those. So, for example, one of the issues that was not addressed through the legislation that is of key importance to many facilities and districts is our ability to influence local planning, community planning, as it has a real substantial impact on our ability to site schools and to see what happens to our schools and neighborhoods as our communities grow and development comes in, and typically we have a very limited voice in that piece. So it's one of those issues that we, along with others such as unfunded mandates in regulatory areas, may also take a look at in addition to the ones that you delineated in your bill. So, in an effort to approach the work in a coherent fashion, what we've done is we've taken the opportunity within the bill to establish three subcommittees to take on the work. The first subcommittee is our assessments committee, which will look predominantly at the physical plant issues. The second committee will look at the financial underwriting that does or does not exist within localities, the state, and the federal government, and to evaluate what the strengths and weaknesses are, as well as to make recommendations on what options we may also want to pursue. And the last committee, which to some of us we believe is probably one of the strongest, is the Educational Standards Committee. Again, for those of us in the facilities world, quite candidly, we take our direction from what the educational needs of our districts are. What are we attempting to accomplish for student achievement? In fact, to the discussion you just had, are our facilities adequate to meet that educational charge and the ultimate educational achievement outcomes that we need for our students? So, again, that'll be the third of our committees that will address those issues. And again, the one thing that the task force has really wrestled with is that given the scope of charge that you have in your bill, it is quite evident that we, for the amount of money that has been allocated for all the functions, will not be able to address all of them comprehensively. So what we will probably be coming back to the legislature in terms of report is we will first of all prioritize the many issues within the categories and try to tackle the top couple of those within the resource limitations and come back and report to you on both items. First of all, what we have been able to do for the resource that you've made available in terms of quantifying, you know, some of the needs that exist for our facilities, and secondly, to raise with you the additional policy issues for future discussions that, we believe will be very critical. So we understand the breadth of the charge, and we did take a pause to breathe as we read through the numbers of things that you're looking for, but nonetheless, we believe we can come back and give you some meaningful information to begin a continued and longer-term dialogue. And so with that, I have also asked the chairs of each of the three advisory committees to give just a very brief overview of the scope of work that they're doing. I point out that we were very diligent about ensuring that we had a broad scope of leadership in those areas. So I have Carol Samuels, who is from Seattle Northwest, who is actually going to be chairing the Finance Committee, who will talk about our Finance Committee. I have Dennis Whitehouse, who is a Facilities Director for the Dalles, one of our smaller districts, who will talk about the assessments process, and I have David Crumbine, who is a board member for the Pendleton School Board, who will talk very briefly about the Educational Standards Committee and the work that his group is doing. Dave?
Good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee, Dennis Whitehouse, North Wasco County School District, The Dalles, Oregon. I chair the assessment committee that's been tasked with implementing and designing a plan to assess all the buildings as outlined in House Bill 2013. The subcommittees felt that there was quite a bit of existing data, and we plan to try to capture as much of that data as we can and do some preliminary extrapolations to see what the magnitude of the facility's needs are. Based on the budget and the timeline, it will be very, very difficult, if not impossible, to accomplish and actually feet on the ground assessment of all the school buildings in Oregon as the House bill dictates. So that's where we're going to begin. We feel that we can develop some very elemental numbers from the existing data and then move forward from that point.
It's just, you're just overwhelmed with the number of buildings? Is that why you think it would be possible?
Well, correct. You know, we believe that there's somewhere in 1,200 buildings, 85 million square feet within the state. To do a feet-on-the-ground assessment would be many millions of dollars, if not tens of millions of dollars, and take well in excess of a year, possibly two.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Carol Samuels. I'm a senior vice president with Seattle Northwest Securities, and I am the chair of the Financial Issues Committee of the School Facilities Task Force. I'm going to be talking from this chart here, which I believe you have a copy of, and just going through each of the tasks that's been tasked to my committee and where things stand at this very preliminary moment. Starting on the bottom of the second page, we've been tasked with determining the amount of money to upgrade, rebuild, expand, and expand existing school facilities. Obviously, that is a huge task and will be done in cooperation with Dennis's committee that will be doing the on-the-ground assessment to the extent we are capable of doing it with the resources and the time we have allotted to us. Moving on to the next page. We've been tasked to conduct a review of other state strategies for funding school facilities for preschool through grade 12. We are in the process of soliciting information from various consultants that will help us with that task. And I have identified the scope of work as compiling and reviewing state roles in financing public school facilities, identifying four or five case study states that we can look at in more detail and try and determine the analogous situation to the state of Oregon, and then coming up with some potential options that are applicable to the state. We do not anticipate a very large price tag for such consulting services, and we are soliciting as well other sponsors as we are authorized under the bill so that we can help defray the costs and make the amount of money that the legislature has allotted to us go still further if possible. Finally, we've been asked to recommend funding mechanisms that will meet the capital needs of public school facilities, including identifying required state and local contributions and funding distribution formulas. Obviously, that's a huge task. And at this point, we are in the process of gathering data so that we can attempt to do that. You know, whether we will be able to come up with the silver bullet solution for all of you to consider next session, my hope is that we are able to come up with a couple of options. We are all very mindful in our committee that we do not want to cannibalize operating dollars in order to fund capital. So our challenge is high, but we think we're up to the task. So,
good morning, Senators. I'm from Pendleton. I've been a school board member for 10 years now. I also serve on the OSBA Board of Directors. I teach civil engineering at Blue Mountain Community College, so I'm somewhat familiar with the engineering challenges and stuff we're looking at. One of the interesting things is, and I...
Why don't you go ahead and start with your name?
Oh, I'm sorry. Dave Crumbine. Dave Crumbine. I'm sorry. I apologize. One of the interesting things we found was that there really are no existing statewide standards, educational standards. There are the building codes, which dictate building requirements specifically and whatnot, but they do not address really educational standards. So one of the things we've begun to do, and actually we've gathered several things from national folks and also various states as far as what they're using for educational standards, we're going to sit down and try to compile a group of those standards that we can agree on across the state. And of course, we have some challenges in this state with the difference between the rural and urban, from, you know, different parts of Portland out to Jordan Valley. We're obviously going to have to address those differences. So that's going to be an interesting task, to bring these together and then get the majority of folks to agree on them. Agreement on standards of any kind are always fascinating. The other issues that are on the table, of course, you've addressed online learning, which is an issue that all school districts are facing. You know, how can we best accommodate that in existing school districts? All-day kindergarten is an issue that I understand is, well, there's another task force looking at that. Present time, to be honest, there probably is not enough buildings out there to handle all-day kindergarten. That would be an issue that would have to be addressed in any requirement. Also, staffing. When you talk about staffing the new graduation requirements that the Board of Education has put forward, the staffing in the math requirements, science requirements, science rooms, particularly from an educational standpoint, are quite expensive to build and have a lot of specific requirements. So that's a standard that we're going to approach very carefully. The learning styles. As we identify different learning styles, back when I went to school, I didn't have the wood stove, but just past the wood stove era, we were all put in one room together and we all learned together. Well, that doesn't work as well these days for whatever reasons. So we're going to have to look at that, you know, different learning styles, we're going to have to address that. So, I mean, that's just a few of the items we've addressed to look at. And, of course, we need to get our work done, the standards, so that the assessment group can really start assessing what's out there and how they fit the existing requirements and what the needs are. So that's where we're headed. I'm looking forward to further reporting back and whatnot as we delve into this in the next month or two and whatnot. I think we'd be happy to entertain questions. Boss?
Well, it's humbling, isn't it, some of the issues we get into here, that you scratch the surface and you realize how deep they really are and how much work is required, and school facilities is like that. Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your work on this important issue. This may have come up when we discussed this bill in the last session. I know there was an analogous study done of courthouses in Oregon recently, and I know there are not nearly as many courthouses as there are school buildings, but I wondered if you've been in contact with the folks that worked on that to maybe get some ideas about how they approached making those determinations and setting some priorities.
Senator Hossett, Senator Bonavici. Sitting to my left is Robin Kerprecht from DAS, who actually was the staff person who helped do that study, and they did bring some of that information to our preliminary efforts as we got started. Frankly, while it is helpful in terms of giving us a sense of how overwhelming the task is for us, there are substantial differences between both the numbers of facilities, the uses of the facilities, and the inventories, but nonetheless, it was instructive to us to see what approach they used. They also brought in their contractors who provided us with a good foundation of what it might take, and we compared that as well to other national studies of similar scope in states who have done what you have charged us to do, and they are in alignment. So again, that's part of what has given us pause to think and come back and have this conversation with you, that both the resources necessary to bring this about, to quantify, to maintain, and most importantly, what are we to measure against? It's easy to say we want you to measure the buildings, but do you simply want us to measure how they exist and what they look like, or do we really want to measure them against the effectiveness of the ultimate outcome, which is student achievement, which is why those two components are so interrelated?
Thank you very much.
Senator Hess, members of the committee, my name is Robin Kirkpatrick with DAS Facilities. And as Chair Caraballo just indicated, we have been able to integrate and collaborate with the effort that the Court Facilities Task Force had gone through. It's been very instructional in the process, and it's provided us with a good base to, as the Schools Facilities Task Force moves through the process, the challenge that's been given to it. The court facilities work has provided us with an excellent base to keep measuring back against. That effort was successful through the information provided to the legislature and ending up with a funding source for some initial work in the court facilities. And we're very hopeful that the information provided through this task force process will, although the biting off the whole piece of work that has been required is probably more than anyone could expect. We are hopeful to generate support when we come back in February before the legislature with some alternative or options for approaches and some associated costs with them. I think it will be, we'll begin to see what kind of piece of the pie we might be able to tackle to begin with. We will be back with a number of options. The work that the task force has done so far, they've jumped in, been doing just excellent work, really a lot of late hours on a lot of individuals' part. The information you've been provided today is the beginning work product from the effort, and we're hopeful that the report, which we are doing some good work on a draft form at this point, will be able to be even clearer and provide some good choices.
Thank you. Bruce. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for having to step out for a little bit if this was covered. In the last year, there were federal stimulus dollars that Oregon received for broadband connection, mostly for hospitals and schools, and I think hospitals were the top priority. And I'm wondering at this point in time, by February, will we have a reasonable map of where we're connected and where we're not as far as the school system?
Senator Hass, members of the committee, Senator Cruz, the schools task force has not made a connection with the group that are dealing with that particular issue. It is out there. We do know that it exists. There is another effort that's going on at the same time, which is the seismic rehabilitation grant program that is supporting some additional improvements in the schools, the same schools that this task force will be dealing with the assessment of. So it is the intention of the task force to enter into communication with both groups that are involved with those efforts so that we can, when we do come back with a report, be able to provide the legislature with some information on how we're avoiding duplication of effort and trying to integrate the efforts. so that, again, the resources, whatever they may be, that end up available to improve some of the, make some of the improvements required by 2013 are supplemental to work in collaboration with these others. So,
follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Senator, please.
Yeah, I mean, clearly there are capacity issues, and we fully understand that. But when we look at virtual curricula, when we look at the new data system, the ability for good connection to the network, I think is vital. And I know for an absolute fact that we probably have more schools not connected than connected at the present time. But it would be nice to kind of have a picture of what the challenge is ahead of us in that area.
Chair Haas and Senator Cruz, I couldn't agree with you more. As a director of facilities, I can tell you that we face a number of practical challenges, not the least of which is that some of our infrastructure, notwithstanding the fact we'd love to have the technologies adapted, do not lend themselves to it. Mm-hmm. And our district is a very good example where we were very successful these past year in passing a substantial bond initiative to allow us to do renovations and repair and to construct four new schools. This has been a substantial issue of discussion. So as we, for example, are in the midst of doing our renovations, in some of our older establishments, North Salem High School, South Salem High Schools, for example, find it very difficult because of the actual construction that actually impedes our ability to try to integrate that. It is on the forefront. From the task force perspective, we will pursue connectivity with all of the other committees that are doing representative work. Again, the work that's been charged in House Bill 2013 is so comprehensive that we hope to pick off the top 5 to 10% to come back and have a sound discussion with you, and understanding that this is likely to be a multi-year, multi-session discussion if the commitment is there, because these issues are so germane to everything that you do and so foundational at the local level. For us, we share the same goal that you do, student achievement, and our ability to do that with this key tool is very critical. Our superintendent will be, for example, one of the first to come before you and say, without the building, which is equally as strong as the teachers and the other resources, we cannot accomplish this, which is why we've put the effort at our level. But again, the one thing that we want to highlight from the task force perspective is that, again, this is a delicate balance. It's a delicate balance because the resourcing at the local level and at the state level are limited. We're having to make difficult choices to continue our investments in facility-related matters against the diminishing resource for the education, and it becomes tough. As a support program, as well as technology and others, it becomes a very hard challenge within the school districts to find that balance. Nonetheless, we've heard you, and we will take that and talk to that committee, as well as those dealing with seismic and others, to bring additional information within our purview to again report to you more holistically.
If I could just one more follow-up, because this isn't just a state funding issue by any stretch. And what I have seen over time, you're an example, Roseburg School District's an example. If the school can make their case and make a very, very valid case to the voters, they will get bond levies. I mean, it's not an automatic no. So,
correct.
So hopefully out of this, we can help build the case for infrastructure needs at the local level so that schools can go forward, not just with state funds, but with local funds as well.
Yes, sir. Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I recognize that I'm about to border on heresy with this question. But if we were willing to look at the 9-month delivery paradigm and shift that to a 12-month delivery, is there anything in your report that would shed light on the constraints from a facility standpoint to a 12-month school year that would enlighten us either it can't be done, it can be done, but it can be done at a cost? So I recognize that's a subject entirely different than what you've been charged with, but nevertheless, if we're looking at how do we extend these services within given facilities. I know from a business standpoint, when it sits idle, it's not productive.
Chair Haas and Senator Morse, the response, we can balance it. The simple issue is, as we evaluate the infrastructure of support for those months that were typically closed, is what we would be able to come and have a dialogue with you about what it would take. So, for example, I'll use Salem-Keizer as a very specific example. We might, like most districts, do not have 12-month school option. Therefore, we're shut down through the summer. If we were to open, the biggest issue, you know, clearly from a physical plant perspective is that we don't have the HVAC systems for the comfort. So we have classrooms even in our late spring and even early fall where those temperatures become problematic for us. So that would be something that we could quantify for you and come and have a discussion. The buildings exist. You know, how districts choose to manage their staffing resources to operate them, you know, is something that can be quantified. The wild card for us becomes the ability to be effective in that instruction. Would we have adequate capacity of facilities to deliver that on a 12-month model? But we can certainly address that.
Thank you. You know, there, I don't know where you put this in your studies, but there has been experimentation with sort of off-campus education on some pilot projects. Nike's Innovation School project goes to apartment buildings during the summer, and kids learn during the summer there, particularly low-income, disadvantaged kids. And there's been more of that where they go to buildings that aren't even owned by the schools or the state and learn in there. So I'd just be curious to see what kind of an option that is out there, if it's even an option at all. When you come back a year from now, what do you suspect this will look like? What will you be able to say, okay, so you see you have this week?
Senator Haas, members of the committee, just for purposes of clarification, the task force will be coming back during the February special session and providing a written report, and it will be the requirement of the bill was that the task force come back with a report that identifies various options for conducting the study and the associated costs for each of those options. And so what the task force has looked at this point in the very initial limited amount of time that it's had to do the work, that range of options is very broad. And so it is my opinion, as support for the task force, that it'd be difficult to answer the question that you've just asked at this time. Once the legislative direction is given in February as to which of the alternatives to pursue, then we will have a much better idea based on that. Then we will be in a position where we will be working with legislative committees through that period of a year and be able to keep the legislature informed on the progress we're making. But to say what that might look like at this time, I think, would be a bit premature.
Okay. I know the full-day kindergarten task force, which is meeting at this moment, is very interested in your work for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Thank you. And we've also frankly received inquiry from pre-K groups and a number of others. And again, in my statements when I mentioned that our task force has been well received is because I think there is a substantial desire out there to see what the breadth of options may be for addressing education comprehensively.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work. Don't get too overwhelmed. I'm going to close this informational hearing, and committee, if it's okay, we'll just power through here, and I think we'll adjourn sooner. And I would like to open an informational hearing on the update on the implementation of integrated pest management plans, which was Senate Bill 637. I've got Amy Code, Tim Stock, and David Williams, if you could come up. Senator Bonamici is the mother hen of this new law.
Been called many things, but never the mother hen.
Just returned to believe I voted for this.
Yes. And I think you did some, you were very accommodating on a couple of minor issues, so I appreciated that. I said that for those who say I always vote no.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association. I'm really just the window dressing here to kick off this panel on the, I know some chuckles about me being window dressing. You are receiving from the committee assistant a copy of what could be sort of termed the previous spot when it comes to pest management and application of pesticides in schools. This was OSBA's sample policy for districts on the use of pesticides and what we call our administrative regulations, which is really the second part of it, which is the bulk of what districts do. And really, this is just sort of where we go from here going forward. Just to say for the record that the Oregon School Board Association is going to be working closely with Mr. Stocks as he moves forward in fulfilling the obligations of the bill, that is the development of a model policy for districts to adopt, and we will, of course, be carrying that to districts forward in the implementation phase once that's developed and working in conjunction with our policy department and the folks at OSU. And with that, as he plugs in, I turn it over to my other colleagues.
There's always this part.
And I just want to mention, we didn't get what you mentioned. We got Tim's slideshow, apparently, but we didn't get a model OSBA.
It's on its way.
Oh, it's on its way. Okay.
Should say big letters, Oregon School Boards Association, right at the top.
Thank you.
Here they go.
I also had the text from an article that I've written, a newsletter article for the next OSMA News, Oregon School Facilities Management Association newsletter, which could be handed out. But so my name is Tim Stock from the Integrated Plant Protection Center at Oregon State University. I'm with OSU Extension. I'm the State Pesticide Safety Education Program Coordinator, and I'm also the OSU School IPM Program Coordinator. Thank you, Chair Haas, and members of the committee for inviting me to give an update on IPM implementation in Oregon schools. So I thought I would just start with part of the presentation, just explaining a lot of what most people already know, just a review of what IPM in schools is all about, and then some of the efforts that are going on nationally and regionally, and then what I'm doing with my program in Oregon and how that relates to Senate Bill 637. And then hopefully have a lot of time for questions. And hopefully this will work, and it doesn't. So I've got the finger here. So healthy buildings, active learners, healthier environment leads to healthier children and higher academic achievement, something that Luis Caraballo mentioned a few times in the earlier part here. And so put this down. So what does this have to do with integrated pest management? Asthma is the main thing. Asthma is the most common chronic illness in children, 4.8 million kids in the United States. It's the number one cause of absenteeism. More than 12.8 million school days per year are lost due to asthma around the country. Most exacerbations are due to environmental triggers, and then common pests in schools are triggers. And then also, pests and pesticides in schools are an environmental health issue. Children are especially vulnerable to problems associated with some pests. For example, cockroaches or asthma triggers and rodent infestations can be disease vectors and also asthma triggers. And then pet sites commonly used and misused can be asthma triggers, especially aerosols. And then many pesticides have been associated with other short and long-term health problems. Children are not little adults. They're still growing and developing, so they have greater metabolic demands, anatomic and physiological differences, and then behavioral differences. They're rolling around on the ground a lot more and on the floor more than adults. IPM basics are education and communication, sort of a pyramid here, cultural and sanitation practices, physical and mechanical control, and then pesticides. Education and communication are not just pest management professionals, pest control companies, and not just custodial staff, though those are the kind of the front line, especially the custodial staff, but also other people in facility staff, in facilities, maintenance people, teachers, kitchen staff. Health inspectors can also play a role. Cultural and sanitation practices, some of that would be reducing clutter, storing items properly in plastic tubs, things like that. The physical and mechanical control could be things like door sweeps, as practical as door sweeps are your outside doors, and trapping, things like that. And then pesticides can be baits and then occasional applications of spraying. Like most people think of pesticides as being an application where you're going to spray something, but that can be a very minor part of an IPM program. So key concepts for IPM in schools are prevention and avoidance through pest exclusion and good sanitation, monitoring and identification of pests, treatments focus on minimum impact on health and the environment, custodians, teachers, principals, pest controls, and others all have a role, which I've mentioned before. A few points I just wanted to bring out that we have kind of slogans in the IPM in schools world that IPM is a process, not a miracle. And it's as much people management as it is pest management. And then the promise of IPM in schools is that it actually has, there's been numerous studies that have shown that 71% reduction in pesticide use, 78% reduction in pest complaints, and lower costs as pest problems are reduced, though their IPM implementation does require initial investment in things like education and sealing up holes and that kind of thing, door sweeps, things I mentioned previously. And then generally, there's no increase to workload of school facility staff. There's another saying we have, do what you're already doing, just think pests. So when you're when a custodian, for example, is going about his rounds doing his things, he has eyes and ears, mostly eyes, and he can see things, and then he can deal with them on the spot. Or if not, he can deal with have somebody else deal with them before they become a larger problem. So what is being done now? There's a National Pest Management Strategic Plan for IPM in schools. I'm part of a Western Region School IPM Working Group. And then, of course, the efforts that you wanted to hear about, my efforts to implement Senate Bill 637. So the IPM in schools, a national effort, is there's a National Pest Management Strategic Plan. And it's funded and created by multiple stakeholders. And its purpose is to increase awareness and education in the school community, and I use that kind of broadly, in a broad sense, and then generate commitment from agencies, organizations, and individuals. And there's a note, I'm not sure if you can see it down there, but there's going to be an updated version out in February. It also is going to be periodically updated. It's sort of a living document. It has sample educational materials and technical resources on it. And there's you can get a link to it on my website, which will be later in the presentation. The Western Region Working Group was established in 2006 with funding from USDA's Western IPM Center. It's been a focal point for interactive collaboration between universities, federal and state agencies, schools, and advocacy groups. We invited people to Portland in 2007 to have a priority setting on what research and outreach needs were in the Western region, many of which I mentioned in the white paper, which some of you might be familiar with, that I wrote. Also, we were in the process of doing a pilot project in Salem, And we've been sharing with Salt Lake City. I've gone there a few times. We've had people from facilities and risk management from Salem-Keizer School District go there with me. We've had them come here, the head custodian, head school IPM coordinator for Salt Lake City. They have a really innovative program, and we're learning and sharing our experiences. So my program, as I mentioned before, I've got funding not only from USDA but also EPA to do funding to conduct these pilot projects, provide training and support, model school IPM plans will be developed, statewide survey that I'm going to be putting online here this month on pest and pest management issues and practices for facilities people to complete. And then I'm making contact with meeting contacts, some presentations with multiple organizations. And then I'm giving presentations and leading up to building up a coalition for promoting success and sharing expertise and experiences. So I'll go a little bit more in depth on each of these. The pilot projects begin with inspections and on-the-ground technical support. And as I mentioned again, we have grant funding for one large-size school district at Salem-Keizer and then also Albany, which we've just begun last month. Inspections, thorough inspections for pest-conducive conditions and pests, things like that, assessment of the overall school, and then training and support for school staff. Districts learn from the pilot school experience and spread to the whole district. That's the idea behind it. And then they create a plan out of that. And the pilots are focal points for training of other districts and pest management professionals and building a coalition. So we've already had a few people from other districts involved in observing and participating in the work that's going on in Salem, as well as part of the western region. We've had people from four or five other states come and observe also. Oops, wrong one. So these are just a few of the things that we've been finding in inspections. The top photograph there on the upper right is, again, probably not too clear to see, but in underneath the sink there on the left and right, there's these bait blocks, rodent bait blocks, easily accessible to children in a grade school. Pellet bait, also not in a classroom, but another location in the school, which can be easily transported by rodents, and old bait formulations found in other strange locations within the school that we probably didn't belong there. Also, clutter and improper storage is an issue. You've got in this photograph here, you've got cardboard boxes mixed with plastic bins. Cardboard boxes are generally not a good thing to store things long term. If it's short term, it's okay, but long term, they can be harbored for certain pests. Outreach provided around the state, giving or have given and will be giving multiple presentations for education purposes and raising awareness. Confederation of Oregon School Administrators later this month, I've been invited to give a presentation at their annual meeting in near Newport. Oregon Education Association, those were canceled for funding purposes. Oregon School Facilities Management Association, I'll be giving presentations in their zone meetings, training in their zone meetings, also in their annual meeting in April, along with we've invited the Director of Facilities from Salt Lake City School District to give a presentation on the cost benefits that they've and how they've gone about doing IPM there, and then have a roundtable discussion as part of the conference there. I've written the article for the OSMA newsletter, which you've got a copy of. We're doing an arthropod ID workshop in February for custodial staff and a few select pest management professionals that have contracts with schools. And then the other part of my, when I was rattling off what my title was, a State Pesticide Safety Education Program Coordinator, I also, as part of that part of my work, I do large recertification courses for pesticide applicators to get continuing education. And I, at my annual event up in Portland, which this year was in Wilsonville just last week. We have it's a chemical applicator short course, and have a structural breakout session. And I'm getting more and more presentations on things that are of use to school IPM people there. Upcoming efforts: expanding to another district, preferably small and or with a high percentage of children in poverty. I'm trying to get a wide mix of school districts that I'm working with for a view to the future, especially when you go down to the third bullet there, model plans. I'm planning to use the pilot experiences and then existing plans as foundations. There's already many school districts in the state, or some school districts in the state, that have plans, Portland, Eugene, to name a few. There's also on the national website that I mentioned, there's a model plan there, sort of a generic model plan. But I really want to have some very good plans that are tailored towards, that are useful for Oregon, and that's why I'm planning to use the pilot experiences as ways of developing the model plans. And then back up to the second bullet, analyzing survey results and using that for future training. Oregon is the first of its kind to have, or will be the first state to have, this online survey done of pest IPM practices and pest problems that different districts are experiencing. There is a statewide or a national school IPM report card that EPA has put out for us to show progress at the national level on a state-by-state basis on implementation of IPM. This survey will have the highest rate of answers, you know, people getting back, because it's going to be available online. We are continually seeking grant funding to continue the work. Most of what I'm doing now in school IPM is from the grant funding that I mentioned earlier. And then also the coalition is something that I'm just on the verge of building. I mean, I've made a lot of contacts. I'm just haven't done that first step of trying to call people together for a meeting or a conference call. But the purpose of the coalition will be to, again, share experiences and promote successes. And then developing a curriculum for coordinator training that is required in Senate Bill 637. This will be in the future. Backwards, yes. Oh boy, what's going on here? Going back in time. Summary and final points. IPM in schools creates healthier environments, healthier children, and higher academic achievement. Oregon is poised to be a leader in the national IPM in schools movement. Have sort of many things going on at the same time. Number one being the enabling legislation and ever more active stakeholders. And I would say that OSU Extension is off to a good start. We the only state with an online survey, as I mentioned, and the first state with simultaneous things going on, the legislation, these pilots, and other activities. Upcoming efforts include the survey analysis, model plan development, coalition, training and outreach. And then for more information, you can visit my IPM in schools link. Just one little thing I'd like to point out, which can't be read there on that, and probably not on your handout, but the bottom of my website, I have something that says, everybody knows something, nobody knows everything, and although the individual may know a little, the group as a whole knows a lot. And that's kind of my philosophy as I go through working with custodial staff and pest management professionals, some of whom have decades of experience that we can all learn by. And then just a few pictures of inspection things. A lot of these are already on the that I've already shown you. So with that, I could pass it on to Ame or entertain questions. I think Ame just has a few minutes.
Ame?
Senator Hass, member of the committee. My name is Ame Code, and I work with the Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides. As Tim said, I think he really covered the bulk of why integrated pest management is important, the benefits to our students, and also just how much has happened since the governor signed this into law just a few months ago. Tim is a very busy man, and I'm happy to be one of the stakeholders that has supported this effort and is hopefully helping to move it forward. I want to bring one small piece of information to your attention. And it really is a small piece, but very important as we look towards having good compliance. Around the country, people who are working to implement integrated pest management in schools, they are finding a great value and really a role for county health, environmental health inspectors. These are the people that go to schools, they go to restaurants, and they're making sure there's food handling safety. And really, the one of the base pieces of information and base work of these inspectors is sanitation. And as Tim clearly pointed out, sanitation is key to pest prevention. From very preliminary conversations with people in county health, we're finding that indeed with minimal training from OSU Extension, county health inspectors can be a valuable part of providing technical assistance to our schools. These inspectors are in our schools 2 times a year every year. I mean, there's close to 2,000 schools, and they're in them all the time, and their role is to be looking for sanitation problems. They would be able to help schools identify potential problem areas and avoid pest problems, and when pest problems are found, right now they do recommend going to seek treatment. They can help find treatment that complies with this law. And as we are in a tight economy and trying to find efficient and effective ways to move this forward and ensure that there is education and outreach to all of our schools, I think that might be a route that we might want to look to as well. And that's really the one piece I wanted to bring to your attention.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Chair Hass. I just want to thank all of you on the panel for your participation on the work group, and especially Tim for your ongoing work on what I obviously believe is a very important issue, and I look forward to continuing to work with you as legislative support. I wonder, Tim, I know we talked about the federal legislation that was just introduced, and I asked Dana to attach it just to let the committee know that there was what seems to be a pretty similar bill introduced in Congress just, I believe, in December of 2009. And I wonder if you have any comments about that. Have you followed its progress? Do you know any chances of success for this passing?
I feel like Congress? I'm in a court a lot. I want to say no comment, but but I also feel like I should say a comment. My colleagues around the country have been sharing emails back and forth, and a lot of it, the first few weeks of it since it was announced, had been really kind of knee-jerk gut reactions, both for and against, a lot of against, with kind of like sound bites. Only recently, and I haven't read it thoroughly. I remember reading it and sending, just skimming through it. I'm very busy. It's not something that I've been paying too much attention to. And it looks like very similar. A lot of similar things to what's going on in Oregon. There are a few parts that might be that didn't understand. Seemed like there might be concerned. But recently, people have been saying, let's look at what some of the more, I would say, cooler heads that have read through it more than I have seem to be saying, that let's look at it and have a comprehensive sort of national of, IPM, school IPM coordinators comment on what we think of legislation, the positives, the negatives, and that kind of thing. So I'm almost continuing in saying in a lot of words, no comment. So.
Thank you.
Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. Thank you.
Other questions or comments?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Okay. First, on national legislation, I prefer the state level rather than add another layer of bureaucracy, but then that's just me. I have a question for David. In your sample regulations, one thing that struck out at me is that products with the lowest percentage of active ingredients, and I know that when you're applying a pesticide, you have to have a certain level of active ingredient. So if you're going for the lowest level of active ingredient in the product you're using, you're putting more inert matter into the mix. So I'm wondering why you would choose to do something like that.
Excellent. Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, the policy before you, we would call it the old state of the art, and what we're looking for now is to move to the new state-of-the-art in compliance with the legislation. This is just merely an example of what sort of was previously in place as we move to the development of a new policy with the help of Mr. Stocks.
Other questions or comments? Thank you all. Appreciate your work. We'll close that informational hearing, and we will go into where rubber is starting to meet the road here.
Ooh.
And introducing some legislation on behalf of the committee. And so I will open a public hearing and a work session on LC8. Colleagues, you have seen this legislation before, and you all voted for it.
Yes.
It is a technical fix on ESDs. Senate Bill 41. Ozzie Rose is here, or was, and
he's there.
If you're willing to come up and give us a brief, although give us a brief.
He's very excited too, but I wonder if
brief. Is that redundant in a message?
Yes.
Because this does nothing but what it does.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Ozzie Rose. I'm with the ESD Association. Senate Bill 41A, we passed last session for the purpose of extending, making permanent the pilot ESD project that we first introduced in 2005. And it was necessary because of how board members are elected and the governance process. After it passed your committee, it got tied up in the debate over how many ESDs we have, and somebody, probably me, went to sleep, and we finished the session without doing anything with this. And we need to do this, or the three ESDs that are currently pilot have to change from their 9-member board of directors, go back to the old system, establish an election by November, and they're, you know, you'll hear different people talk about the value of this and et cetera. There are two things that are very important and very valuable that all three ESDs agree. One is the expansion of the board to include the social service people in their community, the higher ed people, and the business people has started a conversation across borders that is helpful. Second is the election is very, very expensive. If Willamette goes back to this kind of election, it'll cost them about $50,000. And I encourage you to move LC8, and it doesn't solve all the problems in this area, but it's an important, necessary step to continue what we started in 2005.
Okay. Any questions? I have some county clerks signed up. Are they here? Did you want to testify on this? Are you okay? All right.
We're just saying we support it wholeheartedly. We should save the district a lot of
money. Okay. Mr. Chair? I move LC8, dated December 18, 2009, be adopted for introduction at the February 2010 special session.
Senator Cruz moves LC8, dated December 18, 2009, be adopted for introduction in the February 2010 special election.
Special session. Special elections this month.
That's right. Discussion. Objection. Seeing none. Measure passes. Close that public hearing and work session and open a public hearing and work session on LC13. Colleagues, this is
a placeholder.
You see the language regarding task forces. It's not my intent to move anything like that, but this is something that will that was necessary to be in place by November, and it will be used if necessary for pending education-related bills, be they for higher education, kindergarten, ESDs, whatever that may be necessary in February, and that is all it does. Questions?
So do we need to do the same thing?
Again? We need to do the same thing.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move LC13, dated December 4, 2009, be adopted for introduction at the February 2010 special session.
Senator Cruz moves LC13, be adopted for introduction in the February 2010 special session. Discussion? Objections? Seeing none? Any of the comments?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just say that I do have a bill that will be coming before this committee at the request of Chalkboard. I think you're aware of it. So that will be another issue we will deal with during the session.
Okay. And we're likely also to have a bill before this committee dealing with the cleanup bill on AEDs, which Senator Cruz and I co-sponsored last year, technical fixes, that will likely be referred to this committee.
Oh, okay.
Any other comments? Seeing none, we are adjourned.